At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
There's some famous quote about how if you can't measure something, you can't manage it. The it in question today is the key indicator in this American economy right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 14th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The key indicator in the American economy right now, I think we can all agree, is inflation. And to that end, we got the January Consumer Price Index this morning. Prices up 6.4% last month versus a year earlier, as you've surely heard by now. That is, for the record, the seventh straight month of year-over-year cooling of consumer prices. But month to month, that is December to January, prices rose 0.5%, thanks in part to the rising cost of food and housing and gas. Another thing, though, that changed between January and December, the formula that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses to calculate that headline number. Marketplace's Savannah Marr explains why that matters.
The folks at the BLS aren't just tasked with measuring economic changes. They also have to make sure their measuring tools keep up with the times.
So this is a big reason why their jobs are hard.
Wendy Edelberg with the Brookings Institution says tracking the changing cost of things like food, rent, and energy is half the battle.
That's only meaningful, really, if we talk about how important each one of those things is to your overall family budget.
Edelberg says the formula that price changes are plugged into needs to reflect how consumers are actually spending their money. For a while now, the BLS has adjusted the items in its metaphorical basket of goods and the weight assigned to each item every 2 years, says former BLS Commissioner Erica Groshen.
It's now going to update that market basket every year.
And it's going to use consumer spending data from just one calendar year rather than the average of two.
And that's a very good thing, because particularly in a time of rapid price changes, people adjust what they spend money on.
According to Groshen, more frequent updates based on more recent data will give us a more accurate snapshot of inflation. BLS economist Jonathan Church says it's important to try to get that number right, because the CPI is used to calculate a lot of other things, like cost of living adjustments for Social Security payments.
Thousands and thousands of contracts throughout the U.S. in which wages or rents are tied to the CPI. Many states have laws that tie increases in the minimum wage to the CPI.
And it's one measure of inflation that the Fed uses to inform monetary policy. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Tuesday, as has become the norm, traders couldn't quite make up their minds about how they felt about that CPI number. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It's about a 20-minute walk from the headquarters of the Federal Reserve, technically the Mariner S. Eccles Federal Reserve Board building on Constitution Avenue in Washington, over to the White House. Less, probably, if you got a White House ID and you don't have to go up to the visitor's entrance on Pennsylvania Avenue. So Lael Brainard's going to have a pretty quick jaunt over to her new office. The White House announced today that the current vice chair of the Fed is going to be the next director of the National Economic Council, which means that she's going to move from helping to set interest rates to helping to set the economic agenda for the Biden administration. In other words, switching from monetary policy to fiscal policy. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on that one.
Monetary and fiscal policy both sound vaguely money-ish. To keep them straight, I find etymology helps. Fiscal comes from the Latin word fiscus, which means basket. Back in ancient Rome, the government stored taxpayers' money in baskets. Peter Conti Brown at the Wharton School thinks of it this way.
When you hear fiscal policy, think the tough, value-laden decisions that our politicians must make about public money.
So when to pull money out of the basket and spend it, or put more in there by taxing. Whereas
monetary policy is about the value of that money.
And raising or lowering interest rates to change money's value. That's the job of the Federal Reserve. To have someone move from making monetary to fiscal policy?
It's not uncommon, but it's not common.
Harvey Rosenblum worked for the Federal Reserve for more than four decades. He's an economist and says at the Fed, everyone speaks economist. But at the White House or in Congress, you've got
hundreds of dialects that you're trying to understand about where people are coming from, and they're driven by ideology. In monetary policy, people are driven by the data.
At the Federal Reserve, the main job is to keep the economy steady, says Stanford's John Taylor.
I think the person who moves from the Fed to the White House has more information about that than most people.
One example, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who used to be the Fed chair. But Peter Conti Brown of Wharton cautions against having too many Fed alum in the White House.
Will we get a diversified set of views to the president that isn't just reflecting whatever the Fed wants to be done?
Conti Brown says sometimes central bankers fall into a rhythm of groupthink, which doesn't always lead to good policy decisions. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
There we were in our morning production meeting the other day when somebody brought up something called the Federal Games Guild. Turns out it's been around for a while, the Guild has. Started in the Obama White House, now housed in the Wilson Center, an organization, informal by its own description, of government agencies that see merit in using games to help people understand sometimes really complicated policy issues. Elizabeth Newberry is the director of the Serious Games Initiative at the Wilson Center, also the chair of the FGG. Welcome to the program.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
So when you go to a dinner party or a cocktail party or the kids' soccer game or whatever, and somebody says, what do you do? And you say, I'm the director of the Serious Games Initiative at the Wilson Center, and I'm also affiliated with the Federal Games Guild. Then what happens?
Well, typically they ask me to explain Minecraft to them. But more importantly, I explain that I have a background and PhD in game studies from Cornell University, and part of my job is to use games for positive outcomes or social good and to tackle leading policy issues of today.
Well, keep going with the policy issues thing. What makes a good policy game?
Yeah, so at the Wilson Center, we're an international-focused think tank. We also develop games and try to help engage broad dynamics of stakeholders, in my case, often middle school students and up, on leading policy issues. So one of our games is called The Fiscal Ship. It's on the federal budget and national debt.
That is a hard game, by the way. It is a super hard game.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can...
You sound surprised that I've played.
No, it's not that you've played. I've played it before, everything from, again, middle school students to members of Congress. And it's interesting how everyone comes with a different lens to that particular game.
We should say here that Fiscalship is a game about the federal budget, and you get some policy objectives or you choose yours, and then you have to make the budget work. And as I said, and maybe it's just me, I think it's really hard. How does one, however, go about getting involved with the game world for these kinds of policy games that you're talking about? I mean, not everybody has a PhD in game studies, right?
Yeah. So, and thank you again for the, obviously you have played the Fiscal Ship. I should also note that you can play it at fiscalship.org yourself and see if you can do better than we can at it. One of the things
Do you know the secret cheat code for Fiscal Ship? I mean, all games have cheat codes, right?
Well, I can't give all of the secrets, but I will say that the game will stop you if the goals that you set are too hard. But most of the time you can get to the goals and reducing national debt in about 14 moves or so.
Oh, wow. I'm terrible.
I'll slip you the cheat codes then after this talk.
Maybe afterward. But seriously, look, the Federal Games Guild and the Serious Games Initiative, it's serious work, right? Because you want people to learn and understand this stuff.
Exactly. So games can be really used to help motivate people to learn. The other thing that we know mm-hmm. games are really good at is that they're really good at helping to make things that are otherwise really potentially dangerous, such as crashing the federal budget. But also I'm thinking of my colleagues at the CDC who developed VR experiences for everything from labs to coal miners. And just making those experiences safe and accessible and dynamic in a way and testing it and providing that sort of an avenue for training that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah. So what are games bad at then? What doesn't work in your policy gaming world, right?
So I would say that they're not necessarily as good at like a graduate level course in economics, for example. You're not going to get the same thing from reading a 25-page policy brief as you'll get from a game, but more people, I bet, will play my game than they will read a 25-page policy brief.
I'm not taking that bet. That is a safe bet. Outside of policy games, like when you go home and you're done with gaming professionally for the day, are you a gamer in real life too?
Yes, I do play video games. It's a part of the job, but also something that I enjoy. And in point of fact, the reason I got into the field I'm interested in is because there aren't a lot of women gamers out there. I grew up with three brothers who would notoriously keep me out of the Sega Genesis room and that sort of thing while they were playing. And so, of course, I had to go on and make a professional focus to show them that I can do it better than they can.
All right, well, on the theory that they might be listening, because you'll tell them that you're on, can you beat them now?
They probably wouldn't admit it, but I probably can beat them at a couple of things.
Elizabeth Newberry, she is the director of the Serious Games Initiative at the Wilson Center, also the chair of the Federal Games Guild. Elizabeth, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Last summer, natural gas prices were at 14-year highs, thanks mostly to spillover from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Since then, nat gas is off by more than half, which is nice for natural gas customers, particularly utilities that burn it to make electricity for the rest of us. It's not so nice, though, for producers who are now confronting quite the change in their fortunes. And that gets us to the marketplace economic word of the day, hedging. Marketplace's Lily Jamali is on explainer duty today.
Last year, prices of natural gas hit their highest level since around 2008, according to Clark Williams Derry of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
One of the big reasons was that the U.S. was exporting more and more natural gas in the form of liquefied natural gas.
Much of it went to Europe as the continent worked to wean itself off of Russian natural gas. Prices peaked near $9 per million BTUs.
It's now below $3, around $2.50 per MMBTU. So it's a tremendous collapse.
And that's why gas producers hedge, says Bob McNally, president of Rapidan Energy Group. It's a strategy that locks in prices based on expectations for the future.
It's insurance against a bad thing happening. A bad thing here would be the price moves against you.
But hedging can be risky.
If you're an oil producer and you paid a lot of money to insure against the price collapse, but it turns out prices went up. Well, now your investors aren't so happy because in retrospect, you look like you were unwise.
Hedging has declined recently in the natural gas industry. Last year, 52% of production was hedged. This year, it's down to 36%, according to consultants at Energy Aspects. It's not just sellers that hedge. Buyers do, too, and they may be cutting back as well, says RJO Futures' Eli Tesfai, whose clients include agribusinesses that purchase fertilizers made with natural gas.
From their standpoint, at these weaker levels, they don't need to hedge. It's not going to impact their cost up that much.
The bottom line is, given the decline in hedging right now, both natural gas producers and consumers are more exposed to another spike in prices. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Do you really have cats? Oh my gosh, you really have cats. This is amazing. I love cats. Let's go see them.
Dog people, this one might not be for you. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 156 today, almost a half percent, 34,089. The NASDAQ gained 68 points, almost 0.6%, 11,960. S&P 500 basically flat, 41.36. We heard from Lily Jamali about hedging by nat gas producers. So, looking at some natural gas stocks, Antero Resources rose 1.4%. Chenier Energy was up 0.6%. EQT Corporation lifted 0.7%. The CPI showed clothing prices jumped in January. Thus, some apparel stocks. Levi Strauss sagged almost 1.4%. Sagged, get it? That's pretty good. Gap up almost 2% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.75%. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're a little bit more than a week short of 1 year since Russia invaded Ukraine. Official statistics about the number of dead and injured on each side are murky at best, and the global economic effects are still playing out. See also the news this week about rising wheat and grain prices as Russia starts a new series of attacks. On the more micro level, though, we've got a much better idea of the actual personal costs. This war has led to the worst refugee crisis in Europe since the Second World War. More than 8 million Ukrainians have left their country. That is according to the United Nations. So from the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more now on those dislocated individual economies.
38-year-old Tetyana Stetsina fled the southern Ukrainian city of Odessa with her terrified 10-year-old son. She's now living as a refugee in the UK and cannot help but dwell on the huge economic upheaval.
I try to feel positive, but you have your life and 1 second you haven't anything what you had before.
Tetyana was running a corset-making business in Odessa. Just after the invasion, fearing the worst, she closed the company and left with her car, carrying a crucial piece of equipment.
This is my sewing machine. It's simple machine. It's like
now safely ensconced in a small rented house near the English city of Oxford, Tetyana is back in business, making corsets and corset dresses.
It was very successful business, and now I think we very soon will be the same.
Brave words. She's still only doing about 10% of her pre-war trade. But with help from a British charity called Opera, she's re-employed her 8 workers in Odessa and is selling online to customers in the US, the UK and Ukraine. And the business is growing.
Maybe in April I will have salary from my company.
That work ethic has been evident elsewhere. In Poland, which is hosting the lion's share of the Ukrainian refugees, some 1.5 million, they've had great success assimilating Ukrainians into the local labor force.
The data we got already looks quite impressive.
Pavel Kaczmarczyk, professor of economics at the University of Warsaw.
Those people who arrived since the war started, around 60% of them, they are already active in the Polish labor market.
But, he says, contrast that with the situation in Germany, which has taken in just over 1 million refugees and has integrated far fewer into the workforce.
It seems that in the case of Germany, this share is much, much lower. This is below 20%. It was around 17% or so.
Language is the key, or one of them. Ukrainian is much closer to the Polish language than is German. Back in the UK, language has been a key factor in refugee Jana Spaljo's finding her feet here.
I can't speak English. Not really good, but I can express myself at least.
30 years old, she fled Ukraine as soon as the war started, leaving behind some profitable fashion businesses. Having arrived here with virtually nothing last March, today she has a couple of pop-up shops and a website selling Ukrainian women's wear. I met her at this giant trade fair, showing off some of her products.
We have here the jumper, polo jumper, lana trousers. We have it in few colors.
Her business, called Nenya, is making a profit, but she concedes many of her fellow Ukrainian refugees, and there are more than 150,000 in the UK, have struggled because their English isn't good enough or because their qualifications are not recognized.
They have hard life here. They can have the same level of the life that they have before.
She says 90% of those she's met here want to go home after the war. But not Jana, as a young, unattached entrepreneur who's already lost one set of businesses in Ukraine.
We haven't any guarantee that even after the war, they're not doing again.
The Russians won't invade again.
Yeah. We're really unlucky with the neighbor, really.
Much depends on the length of Putin's war. The longer it goes on, the more damage it does, the more that Ukrainian refugees will acclimatize to their new surroundings and perhaps feel they're better off in exile. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Perhaps no one's surprise, small businesses in this economy are still worried about inflation. 26% of them, according to the National Federation of Independent Businesses Small Business Optimism Index, which was out this morning, 26% of them say rising prices are their top concern, even as they are overall a touch more optimistic about how things are going. And that seemed to us to be a good cue to hear from a small business person. Anjali Rodriguez owns the Witty Whisker Cat Cafe in St. Augustine, Florida.
I wake up thinking about work, and that's typically the last thing I do before going to sleep. It's like, oh my God, what do I have to do the next day? You know, like going through my to-do list. So that's something that I'm going to work on in 2023, is trying to create more work-life balance. And so it's hard to turn it off. My biggest worry right now is inflation and the cost of everything. Not only are we trying to cut costs on the items that we purchase, but we're also trying to cut a little bit of our labor costs, in the sense of, like, we're trying to adjust our shifts on our slow days so that we don't have people sitting there twiddling their thumbs. I have 9 people that are part-timers on my team. So right now I've got people, but it's still pretty tough because they're part-time. We do have some students. We've got people who have other part-time jobs, and so I have to kind of compete with the other part-time jobs. Other places like Taco Bell and Starbucks are hiring at $15 an hour, and I just can't do that at the moment, where I'm really trying hard to keep up just with the minimum wage hikes that the state is doing. So cat supplies have increased dramatically, from everything from food to litter to the litter boxes that I use. If they break down and I have to replace them, the litter boxes when I first started were maybe $100 per litter box. Now they're like $200. The cat food that I had originally purchased, I could go to Publix, our local superstore, supermarket, and get it for like $16 for a box of 24 cans. And now it's over $22 for the same exact thing. So I'm having to try and find the same products from other vendors to try and just figure out, okay, how can I cut my costs? So things that are going well. So we've finally started to see our little uptick in adoptions. We're up to 341 right now, which is awesome. I love it when our customers come in, they're like, we just wanted to see you. Do you really have cats? Oh my gosh, you really have cats. This is amazing. I love cats. Let's go see them. And that's what keeps me going. I'm knowing that I'm just bringing a little bit more joy into the world.
Anjali Rodriguez there in St. Augustine. We are an equal opportunity program. Hit us up if you're a dog person or whatever you do. Marketplace.org is the place you can do that. Final note on the way out today. Matt Levin did a story for us the other day, I think it was, maybe last week, about Subway, the fast food chain, and how it was doing all right in these inflationary times as people look for cheaper ways to eat. Well, apparently the company has decided to strike while the iron is hot. It confirmed this morning that it is, in fact, exploring a possible sale. The Wall Street Journal broke the news about a month ago and put the possible price tag at $10 billion, which is just a whole lot of $5 footlongs. All right, here is your moment of economic context. Really, it's more like a moment of full disclosure, actually. The quote with which we began today, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, is often attributed to management guru Peter Drucker. And it is a good line, right? The problem is, according to no less a source than the Drucker Institute at the Claremont Graduate University out in Claremont, California, he never said it. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietten and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On-Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.